Laughing Eyes Kennel presents The Gypsy Musher with Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Hugh Neff. The Gypsy Musher will share stories from the trail, fortune-telling, and memories of mushing years past. Follow The Gypsy Musher on Twitter and visit our website at gypsymusher.com.
Hello and welcome, everybody. This is Robert Forto, and on the line we have our host for The Gypsy Musher, Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran Hugh Neff. Hugh, how are you this morning?
Morning there. Enjoying the day. Sun's just coming up over the tree line here, so we're starting to lose a little bit of that sunlight each day now, and learn to appreciate the brightness a little bit more this time of year when you still have it for a bit.
You know, down here in Willow, the sun is rising at 9:30 in the morning and setting at about 6 o'clock at night. Can you tell our folks down in the States a little bit about that? You know, that always intrigues people about, you know, the midnight sun in the summer and then the darkness in the winter. Can you tell us about that as well as running dogs in the different light situations?
Yeah, whenever I go down to, you know, Wisconsin to visit my buddies in the Milwaukee area, it always blew my mind because the sun would, you know, start setting and then it'd be gone like 5 minutes later. Where up here in the north, people don't realize that it takes a couple hours for it to rise and set each in the winter. And it was probably out of all the toughest environmental, weather or cold or stuff like that, what really was the toughest for me to get used to was more the darkness than anything. Because, you know, the weather in Chicago can be pretty rough in the winters as well. But, having more darkness sets Alaska and, you know, places of the north apart from other parts of the world. And I think that's also what creates so many beautiful vistas and pictures, you know, the different hues, the purple in the sky as the sun sets and the pinks. I mean, it makes some beautiful images for all of us to enjoy. But, yeah, I don't really mind it as much anymore because I love the universe and the stars and, you know, comets and all that sort of stuff. So it has its trade-offs, you know. As a musher, you know, we like the darkness as well because that's what the dogs really enjoy.
I know you mentioned the other day that you were running a 40-miler under the northern lights, the Aurora Borealis, and they got a chance to see that all the way into Mississippi and Georgia just this past weekend. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Maybe have a story of running dogs under the northern lights. I know that it's pretty frequent up here, but it's a marvelous way to see the country on the dog sled with those lights above us.
Yeah, I was blown away by those images I saw earlier this week from, you know, places down south, Wisconsin or Michigan or what have you. So those folks are definitely getting some good lights here lately. I hate to say it, but with all I've done over the last, you know, 10, 15 years and all the beautiful places I've seen, you almost start to take it for granted a little bit. My native friends in a lot of parts of Alaska don't even think it's actually particularly right to talk about the auroras. I think it's almost like a mystical essence that you really should just leave to itself. Obviously, there's scientific reasons why they happen, you know, with the solar flares hitting the atmosphere and all that. But you still enjoy them, you know, no matter if you're a kid or you've been around for 30 years. There's a part of me that takes them for granted, you know, but they're always different. The varying colors is what you're really shooting for. If you've been around a while, you're looking to see some reds and purples and the flowing little snakes that go around in the sky. But often, what it really is just more of a light green in the sky. And sometimes, you know, if you've got snow on the ground, if it's a big enough aurora, it seems like you're, you know, like on Mars or something, because everywhere you look looks the color green, not even up in the sky, but the reflection on the ground as well. So they're definitely, pretty wondrous sights. And, I try to enjoy them every time I see them, but sometimes, you know, you got to keep an eye on the dogs as well.
Sure, sure. So we're just talking a little bit about mushing in the dark. I know we're going to get into sleds and equipment and stuff. Have you found that it's better to run your dogs in total darkness without the headlamp? Or, you know, everybody kind of has their way of doing that. You know, it's really getting down to nature when you're running a dog team on the trails without any light at all. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, believe me, we all love it. I think you get a better feel for the general surrounding environment, the terrain and of the land and all that. But I'll tell you a story about one of my first quests. I was camping, hanging out with two of the, you know, my heroes and guys I really look up to, Timmy Osmar and Rick Mackey. And we're at Biederman's Cabin heading towards Slavin's, and which is on the way towards Eagle on the Yukon River. But anyways, we were talking about it, and I was just being the brash young punk that I always seem to be. And Rick Mackey looked at me and he goes, you know, I love running with my headlamp off, but I'm going to make sure I do it on a trail that I've been on before. And I was like, yeah, yeah, you're right. But, you know, I'm a great musher. I don't need my headlamp on. So I continued on down the trail after taking a break there with him and Timmy for a few hours. And, of course, I keep my headlamp off thinking, oh, I've done the quest before. I know where I'm going. And about an hour later, I look around, no trail markers. My headlamp was off, of course, because I wanted to enjoy the trail and, you know, in the natural light. And I realized that I had gone down the wrong river, another river that cuts into around Biederman's there, and I had to turn the team around, and it was sort of a wake-up call there. You definitely fun to have the light off if you're on a nice, safe, fairly groomed trail, but if you're out in the middle of, you know, the quest or something, and you don't know what the trail is going to be like, you don't know what Mother Nature's done, if there's going to be maybe a hole in the ice on some side hill along the river there or something, it makes a lot of sense to keep a light on. And with the lights nowadays, they have different settings for them too. A lot of people like to have the really bright lights so they can stay up easier perhaps, or because they're keeps their dogs more alert. But I like to have a little bit of a more dimmed down light. Some folks even use the old style, you know, those old batteries with the square blocks, and you use the D cells, just because it gives off a different color of light. It's more of a yellow light than a white light. It's each musher has their preference, but there's ways to you know, mix it up and not always have to do it the same way all the time. But yeah, as you get older, you learn to be a little bit more cautious on the trail, and having a light on is definitely a good idea in the long run. And you can tell, you know, a little bit more about which dogs are really working hard, especially in training. You want to keep it on, see which tugs are tight and all that sort of stuff.
So if we could jump right into this kind of equipment segment of the show, let's talk a little bit more about these lights. When you're on the Iditarod or the Quest, kind of the rule of thumb is to run your dogs when it's, you know, it's when the sun is not at its height, possibly at night. How do you conserve your battery life and that sort of thing on a multi-day race, maybe a 9 or 10 day race like the Iditarod, when you only have, you know, so many batteries, so much, you know, time with these lights? How do you work it, Hugh?
You know, you got your lithium. They're going to last a little bit longer. I can just get mine basically at any of the, you know, the Walmarts of the world or the Freddy's or whatever we have up here in Alaska. And they're usually just triple A's or double A's depending on the type of light you're using. Some folks have to plug in at checkpoints, so they might carry extra batteries. But we overstock ourselves for these races. We send out a lot of extra supplies that we can always mail back or have our handlers pick up if we're in the quest. In the Iditarod, we just put them in a drop bag, and Iditarod will bring them back for you. Unless it's food or something, and we'll just give that to the local villagers. But with batteries, I usually have 3 headlamps in my sled with me at all times. I remember one of my earlier quests, I had to actually was going past Roan about 10 miles, and I noticed a musher off to the side of the trail, and it was Dee Dee Genro, and she actually asked me if I had any couple batteries that she could borrow. Or not batteries, actually. It was actually a headlight that she had go out on one of her lights. And, you know, so we'll actually help each other out on the trail, too. So that's another reason to possibly bring extra parts, is because, you know, it doesn't hurt to help your fellow man out. We're racing against each other, but we're looking out for each other as well. So whatever, whether it's runner plastic, you know, stuff to wear for your socks or your hands or batteries, you're definitely, as a musher, you always need to try to be prepared. Obviously, over the years, I've had some mishaps where I wasn't, and it got me in the end. So, you know, you learn through the school of hard knocks.
Is there anything in particular that you take every time? And I'm mentioning this because I remember last year, the Scottish guy, Waddy McDonald, had on his Homer Simpson pajamas at the start of the Iditarod. Is there anything that you take along every Iditarod Yukon Quest that you just can't deal without? Something other than that may be necessary, such as batteries or headlamps or a particular food or something. Is there something you always pack for yourself?
I cannot believe there's another musher who wears Homer Simpson underwear. I thought I was the only one. And I'm not kidding you either. I really do have a pair. Anyhow, well, I always have my juji fruits and my cough drops, trying to keep my throat from that Arctic air can be really tough on your throat, so you need to have liquids, my emergency, some type of Tang or some type of vitamin C that you can get into your system. You always, obviously, you know, the essentials, some type of water, something with water in it, whether it's a juice or coffee, what have you. If there's one thing that you never want to forget out there, well, you know, it's like in Boy Scouts or anything when you're out in the wilderness, you have to have, you know, knife, matches, or a lighter, some type of light. I even bring candles, to tell you the truth, man. And I'll actually, sometimes when I'm resting the dogs, I'll just put a candle up in the ground in front of the team, light that candle just to give the trail a little bit of ambiance. So maybe those dogs will veg out on staring at that flame flickering, and it might have them go to sleep faster. But, yeah, believe me, the more you race, the more you realize what you need to have out there for your dogs and for your sled, as much as what you need for yourself. And it's usually, obviously, a rookie mistake. They usually bring a lot of stuff they don't need. So as you get along in life and you learn how to clothe yourself properly, like I've learned through the years that I like to wear like a nice thin sock up against my skin and then put the heavier socks on top of that. In the old days, I'd have thick, you know, socks, and I'd be sweating like crazy and get trench foot and all that. So it really starts with, you know, the foundation of your body. You've got to take good care of your feet and your hands and stuff like that.
Well, I know you mentioned in a show or two back that you travel rather light on these longer races like the Quest and the Iditarod. And then you'll see, like you just mentioned, the rookies and what they call the rookie hump or the rookie bump in their sled, where they're just packed to the gills. Have you found over the years that as your equipment dwindles down, whether it's in size or what you bring, that you tend to forget things that you need along the trail? Like you mentioned with Dee Dee, she burned out a headlight bulb or something. Is there something that you're always seeming to forget, you know, 800 miles into the race, oh man, I forgot this or that?
Usually about 800 miles into the race, I have forgotten how tough it is on your body. And a lot of mushers at the end of these races that are like, oh, I can never do this again. And then they give it a few months of rest and relaxation, and then they just can't wait to get back out on the trail again. I'm getting better, you know, as far as knowing the essentials and trying not to go too low on what I'm packing. I will tell you what I overpack the most of and what every musher should, and that is food for your dogs, because you do not know if you're going to be caught in a storm. You know, what? There's all type of delays in these races. Mother Nature, you know, is in charge in the long run. So I'm always going to make sure you have enough snacks, because, you know, as these races go on 800 miles into the race, these dogs' metabolisms are so high that they're just eating like madmen. And it's up to you as a musher to make sure that they're getting enough food.
Speaking of feeding the dogs, one of the required pieces of equipment is the cooker. A lot of people that don't do camping with their dogs, or they don't do long-distance races or even the mid-distance races up here in Alaska, have no idea what a cooker is. Can you tell us about that?
You know, just a circular metal container that you put a little bit of white gas in there, perhaps some heat, something like that. You light it and then you put a smaller pot inside of that, and that's how you warm up your snow or your water that you get, you know, from a river or one of the checkpoints. And that's what you're going to mix with your meat to thaw it out, or your human food, or your kibble, or all types of stuff. You know, those cookers are a very essential part of what is going to have your meal prepared properly. Without them, you'd be in a world of hurt. That's why I love watching the old Iditarod videos and seeing what those guys were using back in the day. You know, they had no clue when they first set off doing these races. And it was, you know, back in the day, they were basically only feeding dried kibble a lot of the time. So things have definitely evolved incredibly over the few decades. The last few decades, definitely.
So we're talking to Hugh Neff, Iditarod and Yukon Quest veteran. This is the Gypsy Musher. You can follow us on Twitter at Gypsy Musher, as well as Facebook and our brand new website, gypsymusher.com. We're still in the process of getting that up and going. All of the behind-the-scenes stuff is up and running, and within a few days, we will have all of our past shows as well as alerts and things for our new shows coming up. We're going to air them on Thursday evenings as well as Sundays, and then pretty soon we're going to air them pretty much on an iTunes rotation basis, so folks in the East and even kids in school can listen to them at their leisure through iTunes. So before we get into sleds and things, Hugh, let's talk about the sled dog of the week. Last week we talked about Goldie. Who do you want to talk about this week?
I hate to say it because I keep on bringing up all these young little two-year-olds I got, but boy, they're definitely proven themselves so far. They've got a harden in their bodies a little bit, but this other new little girl I got, her name's Havana, and she is just something else. Tiny little thing, only about 30 pounds, maybe 35. Most of the dogs in her litter are good, but they're just a little bit, they haven't matured as quickly as she had, and I've had her up in lead with a bunch of the other, I got a lot of small 35 to 45 pound girls up in front that I, you know, I'll have 6-7 dogs up in lead when I'm training, but Havana just has that attitude that wants to please. She sort of reminds me of this dog that Jeff King used to have. I don't know if you've seen the video where this dog would just jump 3 feet up right into Jeff's arms and he'd catch the dog. And Havana does the same thing. In fact, with Havana, you have to be careful because, you know, I usually have 3 or 4 dogs running around the yard playing loose. And with her, if she's, you know, in the mood, she's going to be on a beeline for you, and she's just going to go flinging right into your arms. And if you're not watching, you know, she could bonk you on the nose, which has happened before. A lot of people might try to train down this type of, you know, emotional outburst. But for myself, this is what I thrive on, training to get the dogs to be as energetic as possible. It can make it a little crazy at times when you're hooking up a team and that sort of stuff. But for me personally, it's a lot of fun to feel all that energy that they have. And not only to have that energy at the start of your run or your race, but throughout the race, if you can learn to develop their habits properly. But Havana is definitely one of those girls that just really is a joy to behold, and I really can't wait to spend a lot of time with her out in the trail.
Have you found that the males or the females have a little bit more of that energy, that more of that human connection? Have you found one sex or the other to be one way?
Oh, no, you know. It's like anything in life. You can stereotype all you want, but, you know, realistically, every boy and girl has their different, unique characteristics. I'd say maybe perhaps the girls develop obviously a little bit earlier as far as being stronger headed and better leaders. The boys are a little bit, I mean, half my young boy leaders, I can tell you before I even put them in lead what they're going to do the first time I stop in the trail. And we all know what that is. They're going to go right for the next tree and start marking their territory. So I think the girls might be a little bit more level headed when it comes to potty training out on the trail. But, yeah, I've got a lot of great up-and-coming, you know, leaders. That being said, you really don't know that much about a dog until you get them out on, say, at least a 4 or 5 hour run. And then you can have a better feel for what they're all about. I just, the more I've gotten into mushing, I just look at dogs differently now than I used to. It's not as much about their bodies as it is their minds and their hearts. And that's really what I'm focusing on in training, is not, you know, who's the speedster up there, but who wants to please, who's getting along with all the other dogs. Attributes such as those are what I'm really looking for.
And speaking of the bodies, is there a particular time, if you're not going to breed, that you spay or neuter your dogs, or do you just kind of let them work themselves out? Because, you know, a good sled dog you may not see until they're three years old. And then at that time, you know, a female in particular has had six or seven heat cycles during that time. Is there a rule of thumb in your kennel?
Oh, definitely. I try to be I only typically keep maybe four or five girls out of the 40 dogs that I have intact. The boys, 80 to 90% of them are all neutered. It's like Bob Barker used to say, you know, you're doing right by the animal. You're allowing them to have more freedom, I believe, because you don't have to worry about, you know, loose dogs going around the yard and impregnating other dogs. I think the boys that have bad attitudes, a lot of that is testosterone, and I think clipping them might make it a little bit more easily manageable to take care of them. That being said, though, a lot of these boys, they don't change at all. They're going to be, you know, alligators. If they're going to want to mess with other dogs, that's, you know, just sort of their temperament. But yeah, it's just it makes sense. You keep your kennel at a manageable level, and you know, who wants to have accidental breedings? If you want to have dogs bred, make sure that they are the dogs that are probably the best fit for you and what you're looking to do with your kennel.
Right, right. And have you found that
a lot easier to take care of them in the cold too, especially with the boys' private parts.
That's a good point. Have you found that dogs that you get from other mushers, are you looking to get these guys that are intact and for potential breeding purposes down the line, or does it matter to you?
I'm at the point in my career where I don't really necessarily need to get dogs from other mushers to race with, but I do like to check out different lines of dogs. And like I said earlier, I'm really focused right now on trying to get back to the older style native village dog, and the dogs that I really have enjoyed that I've seen from, you know, different races are the dogs from the northwest coast of Alaska, specifically from the Kotzebue area. So I got some dogs from my buddy John Baker, and I won't be getting those guys. One of them is neutered, but John had already done that because the dog wasn't a good weight keeper. Another great reason to get a young dog neutered, especially a boy, is if they're skinny and they're bad weight keepers. Getting them neutered will definitely thicken them out over time. But the dogs,
right,
I got from John, I'm definitely planning on breeding in the future. Sport and Effie, they're more of a throwback to the old-style husky. They're not as houndy and sprinty. I mean, I've got, you know, my fastest dogs are hound dogs, you know, but that doesn't mean a hound dog is going to be great for 1,000 miles. And so I think I prefer the huskier type of dogs. I think they have a better temperament for just eating is a main deal, as well as perhaps going on longer runs compared to being really fast for the short term.
So let's talk a little bit about sleds and things. I know that was the topic that you mentioned when we spoke earlier in the week. What do you want to tell our listeners about sleds and other types of equipment that you use?
Newer racers, competitors, be real with yourself. I remember before my first quest, I was up until 4 in the morning fixing a sled because I had run into a moose with a team a couple days before the quest that year, and I had a sled from this guy named Percy Dyke down in Nana. So I totally took it apart and put in thick wood that I had got from Grubsteak Feed, I believe, or Cold Spot, and I think it's Cold Spot actually. And I just wanted to have like a tank because I knew as a rookie I knew I was going to be hitting trees. I didn't know the trail at all and the turns and all that sort of stuff. As I've, you know, mushed over time, I know to bring stuff, essential repair equipment, such as, you know, what have you, a wire, duct tape, hose clamps, maybe a bit of a hockey stick or something like that to use as a splint. But in the old days, when I was just starting off, I definitely had bigger sleds. just because, you know, I didn't know what I was doing. And I don't think newer mushers should be necessarily all about racing. They should be about traveling, the adventure. And once you get 4, 5, 6 days into a race and you know what you're doing, you have a feel for everything, then you could be concentrating on, you know, being competitive. But if I had it to do over with, I definitely would have been a little bit less competitive starting off in my career, and just concentrated more on, you know, traveling on the trail properly. I have a buddy in Kotzebue actually making a sled for me right now. His name's Darren Nelson, and he's John Baker's cousin. And, you know, the sleds we use nowadays, typically 4.5, 5-foot baskets. They're less, you know, lightweight than the old days, less wood being used, more of some type of lightweight titanium or something, which can break, but it's definitely more durable. But I think people would be amazed how high-tech the sleds are getting over the years, and smaller as well. I'm not the only person that's running smaller sleds. A lot of folks use the seats on their sleds. I've done that before. I've also had my feet trapped beneath them going through some rough ground, which is I just thought was too big of a danger to use a seat anymore. I just don't think the seat suited me either, just my style. I like to run up hills a lot and kick, and I like to do it from behind the sled compared to being on the side of the sled. But you just have to be good at packing, and a lot of that has to do with training a lot and doing a lot of long runs out there.
So tell us about those double sleds. I guess are they called trail dragger sleds, Hugh? The ones with the section in the back where you can have a seat or a cooler or whatever. Tell our mushers that may not be familiar with those.
Well, they came in when Jeff King started using them probably, 5, 6 years ago. And Martin was right on it right away. I remember this great video of Susan Butcher watching Jeff come into, I believe, Galena or Nulato, and she just had the biggest smile on her face. And she was just like, man, I wish these were invented when I was competing a few years back. But they're a great idea. A lot of folks use them. They're good if you have back issues. I know Sebastian was a big proponent of them because he had could rest a lot easier and then, you know, get a workout when he needed to. And they are definitely a help in windstorms. If you're going into a wind, you need to stay low out of that wind. It's a lot easier just to sit on a seat than to, you know, have to scrouch down on your knees. So there are benefits to them. It's a great way to shift the weight of the sled so it's not all up in front of you. But like I said earlier, they're just not my style. Plus, my aunt used to make fun of me all the time and call me an old man for using one.
So does anybody still use the old-style basket sled, you know, the wood ones with the lashings and all that, or has people gotten away from that?
I'm sure some folks out there still do. I think it'd be a great throwback race to just make that. Somebody should have a race where you have to have all, you know, wooden sleds. That'd be sort of cool. But yeah, you see it a lot in the ceremonial. I think Sonny Linder had a really nice one last year that he had him and his family on, and you see them around, you know. Definitely a lot of tourism folks use them. Joe Runyon used to make huge 14-foot ones, you know, for hauling, you know, wood or fish or what have you. And those are really good for training. A lot of people will use a thicker, you know, wooden sled if they're on rough areas in Alaska, but for racing, they're usually the high-tech stuff nowadays.
So tell us a little bit about the bag or you know, the part that is essential for every musher where you keep your gear. What exactly is that designed for, not only for the gear, but also to carry a dog too, right?
Yeah, you usually have some little necklines that are right in front of you where you can put the dog, you know, in the sled safely and securely. That's part of the race rules for every race. The dog's got to be in the sled, not on top of it. And then you'll have your cooler with your meat snacks up there. You usually have your sleeping bag towards the front, you know, snowshoes on the side with your axe. And then a lot of us have little pockets on the sides of the sleds, on the interior of them, that will keep a lot of our smaller gear on, and, you know, batteries, stuff like that, where I try to actually have a pocket on my body as well, where each pocket, I know I'm putting a certain thing into that pocket, because all of us mushers know how much time we waste touching all of our pockets trying to find something, whether it's a, you know, a snap or your phone or what have you. And that's just, it gets annoying after a while if you're always looking for stuff. If you have your body organized where you know where each little thing is you need that's on your body, it makes life a lot easier.
So when you have to put these dogs in the bags, obviously from, you know, in between checkpoints, if one of them goes down hurt or something, how do the dogs respond to that? Obviously, that's not something you can train for. And if you're 50 miles from the next checkpoint, how do you deal with that?
It's not a bad idea to you know, try, you know, one out that you think might not, sooner or later, I have to be going the sled in training just to get them used to, you know, being behaved. And a lot of dogs are going wild and don't want to be in that bag.
Right.
That being said, in these races, when we are putting dogs in sleds, it's not usually because they are hurt. It's because they're tired and we're giving them a break. And that's what people really need to realize, is how you care for your dog's energy is how you're going to perform in the long run. So if you are watching your dogs and you have the bond with those animals, you can tell that something might be off with the dog. Instead of letting that situation get worse by pushing the dog farther, take that dog, put it in the team. It's going to slow you down for an hour or two, but you know what? That dog might be great for the next 5 days afterwards because of what you're doing now. Don't let the situation get worse. And so, you know, and Jeff King, you know, he was the master of actually putting dogs in the sled to start races just to rest them, and then he'd throw them up towards the lead later on in the race, later on in that run, just to keep his pace going faster. You know, a lot of folks don't want to run dogs that have been in a sled bag. They're like, oh, well, he's too used to it now, he's never going to want to run again. But I've carried dogs before, and they get used to it. You just hang out with them and talk to them, maybe give them a little snack or something, pet them a lot. That's going to mellow them out. Let them, you know, if it's comfortable back there, if you have a little, you know, dog jacket or something for them to lay on, make a little bed for them, like a nest, they're going to be fine back there. You can't stress them out by stressing out yourself, though. Whenever you have a tough situation, you have to, you know, try to remain calm, and the dogs really feed off the human's energy.
So is there a rule of thumb that you can tell us about handling the sled when you have a large dog in there that may be moving around, you're going through some turns or, you know, possibly the steps there in the Iditarod?
It's in the video this year, man. I had to carry Joker down the steps, and it didn't make it into that video, but he made it into the video in Nikolai when he got into my sled bag and started eating food. I'd carried that dog for a long ways, thinking that he was going to get better. That's another element of this is if you're waiting for your dog to get better and you've just carried them for 30, 40 miles, maybe you don't necessarily need the dog, and it's best for both you just to leave that dog at the checkpoint instead of continually carrying it, going, oh, it's going to get better, it's going to get better. 9 times out of 10, they're not going to get better. If it's a massage of a wrist or something of that nature, no, that's not too bad a deal. But if it's, you know, if they're not eating perhaps, or if they just look a little sick or whatever, probably best just to drop the dog off and go from there. But yeah, believe me, man, it got dicey going down those steps. You can't waste a second lollygagging and staring off at the trees, you know, being a tourist out there. You got to stay focused, keep your eyes on the team in front of you, and it definitely helps knowing where the bad parts of the steps are as far as the tight twists and turns. And just easy, easy, easy. You got to be calm with the dogs, you know, try to get them to go at a relaxed pace. That was a nice education for me last year's Iditarod, getting to travel with Sebastian Schnella and just seeing him just put so much energy into slowing his team down that he had his dog team with tight lines going down a mountain just because that's the way he trains his dogs. It's not necessarily the way other mushers do it, but for him, he was staying true to the way he runs his team. And so you cannot go too slow going down a mountain. Unless, of course, you got another team behind you, then you might want to make sure there's a little gap between both teams. But going down mountains, no reason to be in too big a hurry, because you know what? You just, the faster you go, the more chance of, you know, a dog getting tired or hurt. So it makes more sense to try to open up a team and make some speed in the flatter parts of the trail than going down some 4,000-foot mountain.
You know, Hugh, a lot of people have heard about the steps. You know, that's kind of one of those infamous parts of the Iditarod, and me included, being the rookie, I have questions about that when I go through through that portion of the trail. And I know Allie Zirkel had a video going last year of her kind of quest down that portion of the trail. Can you tell our listeners, especially the Iditarod fans, a little bit about that? How far down is that? You know, people assume that it's, you know, miles and miles, but it's really not that far. Tell us about the terrain, how long it takes to get down that portion of the trail, and some of the obstacles besides the trees, because, you know, many of people have ran into trees there and ended their Iditarod right there.
I know, and it's a tough way to go. I remember a few years back, I was going down the steps behind my buddy Jerry Sousa, and all of a sudden we heard some screaming, and we looked over, and this lady had hit this tree so hard that her gangline had snapped from her sled. And so she was walking down the hill trying to pull her sled back up while her dogs were a few hundred feet down the trail wrapped around some trees. And it was down at the base of the steps, so Jerry and I parked our team, secured our teams off, and then we went and helped her, get her dogs all, they're all tangled up and everything. So in instances like that, when you're on the trail, you better be out there helping out your fellow musher, or else you will not be highly looked upon by everyone else in the long run. So the steps can be interesting, but to be quite honest, they're just a couple chutes, you know, and there are some tight turns. What you really want to do before the steps, though, and this is a key that maybe rookie mushers might not realize, is don't take a break, you know, for 10 minutes before you decide to go down. Try to get a little bit of the energy out of that dog team so that when you go down the steps, they aren't flying down, you know, they're at a more controlled pace. And then when you get to the base of the steps, when you're away from all the chutes and in a safe spot there, there's a nice little opening on the river area there where you can just take a rest and save your dogs for the next hills that you're coming up to. But you never want to go down a mountain with a fully charged up dog team. Coming from the Quest, though, the Quest has much more difficult terrain, much more difficult. Iditarod, more difficult because of the coast, I'd say, but the Quest has a lot tougher downhills, believe me. And even as far as the Iditarod goes, there's some really good uphills that are a little bit more interesting. Say, going to the Topcock Hills, the steepness is pretty good. Or going down, I'd say the Gorge is actually a lot more technical. Not a lot, but it's longer than the steps, and it's a little bit more dicey, shall we say, because you might have roots jutting up from, you know, the ground where the trail markers or people who put in the trail have tried to clean up the trees, but they didn't realize that the bush went farther and there might be something poking up. You have to worry about hitting into your sled. And plus there's a creek that you're zipping back and forth across. So that can be a little bit dicey year to year, but they do a great job trying to make it as safe as possible. They put in a lot of snow bridges down at the bottom there where typically the water is going to be raging. It might be open in a couple spots that you have to navigate around. But experience is a main key. Going downhills, it doesn't hurt as well, perhaps, if you're a little bit nervous. So go ahead and take a couple of those tug lines off the back dogs. And if they're an animal that's not too zany or too hyper, they'll go down that hill at a controlled pace, but you'll have less power tugging on that sled. Some people even wrap chains around their runners, say for Eagle Summit. That's doable, but not necessary all the time. But, yeah, it's definitely a part of the race where you have to be, you know, totally focused on the job at hand and, you know, just don't stress yourself out. A lot of people are so worried, they create these paranoia inside themselves about these areas that they actually make it more dangerous than it is. I mean, it's like on a tight corner, the last thing you want to be doing is going hard on your brake, because you know what's going to happen when you go hard on your brake? You're going to suck yourself right into that tree and wipe out. So you have to know how to almost be like a skier and which side of the sled to lean on to get around those, you know, those tight corners in a safer manner. A lot of it's just training. You got to do it in training. You got to go find some hills and get out there and experiment.
And that's a great point that you brought up, the skiing analogy. It is very similar, especially hitting those turns. You know, some people will kick their foot out to the left or the right, depending on that turn, off of the runners. You see a lot of guys doing that. That takes some practice and some skill. It's not something you can just jump on the sled tomorrow and master, you know, on your first training run, right?
Oh, yeah, man. I always tell people that the sled is my dance partner, and I'm just back there dancing with it. And you're out there dancing a lot on some of those hillier sections, you know. So you just have to get a feel for, you know, how the sled moves and go with the flow. And, you know, I think a lot of folks might not realize that we dog mushers who are doing this long-distance stuff, we have to be fairly athletic ourselves. I mean, I play a lot of basketball. I like to shoot hoops a lot to loosen up, or I go hiking a lot or what have you. So as a musher, you have to learn to take care of your body and try to be as athletic as you can as well.
Another great point. I hope in the future shows, Hugh, we can kind of dissect each one of those races, the Quest and the Iditarod, and talk about not only what you see on the trail, but about the race itself. You know, so many people are interested in the race other than what they see on Iditarod Insider, or they're looking on the internet. That's what this show is all about, is that lifestyle that you guys live on the trail. So hopefully in the future we can talk about those in separate shows, each one of those races. Hugh, we have about 3 minutes left. What's coming up next time? Do you have anything else you want to share? You know, the show is yours.
I got a buddy, Bruce, actually coming in next week from Spokane, Washington. So it'll be fun to have a visitor and run some dogs with him. Been real busy on the home front as far as if folks want to go to Facebook here soon, my page, I'm going to have order forms ready if people want to support the kennel through buying a hoodie or a t-shirt or a hat or a patch. We got a lot of cool merchandise that we've been working on. And just getting ready for the school tour in December. Looking forward to checking out, you know, the old haunts there in Rapid City. I was a fan of the Deadwood TV show. We got a litter of dogs actually that are named from characters from that show. And so I'm looking forward to seeing, you know, where Wild Bill Hickok and Calamity Jane and, you know, the history of a major part of the West that I haven't really been to in quite a long time. And I just love sharing the adventures of this sport and the dogs with kids, and just to see the joy in their faces as they get to witness a part of life that a lot of them don't know a lot about. And that's what these races should be about as well. The race is great, but the race isn't what this format of dog mushing is all about. It's about the land. It's about sharing and celebrating the lifestyle that we're so lucky, all of us, to be a part of. And that's what I really am hoping to do with this radio show, and all that I do is, you know, help spread a little bit of joy to others, and hopefully give a lot of these younger folks some initiative to get out there and, you know, seek their dreams if they want to be dog mushers. Because, you know, I did this on a shoestring budget, and I'm still, you know, nickel and diming it to make it in this world, because, you know, life isn't easy nowadays. But with the will, there's a way, and, you know, that's what I'm trying to do each and every year, is just, you know, get the most out of this incredible dream that I've been so fortunate to be a part of.
Well, and you're living it, and you're sharing it with a whole bunch of listeners now. People are really picking up this show. I know we missed our show last night, and people are asking all over the place, what happened to the show? So obviously you already have some fans out there, Hugh, and I look forward to continuing on. So we'll see you guys next week, same time, be 4 o'clock Alaska time, 8 o'clock Eastern time, and we'll make sure we post that all over the place. Hugh, it's been a pleasure. We'll talk again soon, okay?
Yeah, and always remember, if you're a true Dog Mushing fan, your number one hero, your number one idol, isn't a dog musher, it's the dogs. And
there
I hope everybody knows that out there.
There you go. So on behalf of our host, Hugh Neff, and my name is Robert Forto, the Gypsy Musher on Facebook and Twitter, we'll see you next time. Goodbye.
Peace.